We're going to continue with the ABC of scattering today, and want to get going on part 7. And in the series so far, you might remember that we've been following early mankind, and more specifically Abraham's family, extended family, through their wanderings, through their God-ordained wanderings. As we follow them, as we've been following them step by step, I've been trying to get across to you how their travels might be symbolic of what God seems to be doing with his people in our age today. The last time, believe it or not, was way back on in part 6. It was in March the 12th, was the last time I spoke on this. And of course, then we got into the Passover subjects. But at the end of part 6, we were at the end of Genesis chapter 32. And there we left Jacob and his young family at a place called the Yabbok River. Actually, the place changed the place name to Penuel, and that was after they traveled all the way from the home of Jacob's scheming, duplicitous, double father-in-law Laban. After wrestling with Jacob at the Yabbok River, the Lord gave Jacob a permanent limp and changed his name to Israel, after which Jacob, now Israel, changed the name of the Yabbok River area to Penuel, which means facing God, because Jacob had looked upon God, had faced God, looked upon God, and survived. Please turn to Genesis chapter 33. Genesis chapter 33. And as we move into chapter 33 now, we see more mentions of the southbound travels of Jacob, again now Israel, and his young family. And as we continue, I want you to notice in the scriptures that we're going to read the frequent accents on the concept of travel. So, and Jacob and his family were traveling south, and as they traveled south, they soon ran into Esau, Jacob's estranged brother. Esau was accompanied at the time by 400 of his men. So you can see how Jacob would have had problems with that. But surprisingly, Esau greeted Jacob very warmly. And again, we're trying to see examples from these accounts. And I think that Esau gets a lot of bad press, but in this case, this is a great example of reconciliation for us, for God's people today. But there's a limitation on this reconciliation, because after their reconciliation, Esau suggested that Jacob and his family, and Esau's family, that they should travel together. Genesis 33 and verse 12. And he said, "Let us take our journey and let us go, and I will go before you." However, and there's a possibility of perhaps not wanting to chance the possibility of a resurgence of the animosity that they had between them, or any other trouble between the brothers, because we know that the brothers were so different in so many ways. So Jacob wisely declined. He made some excuses not to do so, not to travel together with Esau. And perhaps, again, I'm all for unity within the church, and unity is a great thing. But perhaps this is another wise example for God's people today. We can love and accept our brethren in other Church of God groups, and that's great. But if we have serious doctrinal or leadership differences or other kinds of differences with them, it may not be best for us to fellowship with them on a regular basis. And again, I'm all for church unity, and I look forward to the time when it does all come together. But, you know, there has to be wisdom involved there as well. Anyway, Esau and his men returned to their home at a place called Seir, while Jacob's group continued southbound towards Jacob's father Isaac's camp. And they thought, Jacob thought evidently that that Esau, his father, and that group were still in a place called Beer Lahairoi. We'll see that as we go along. But Jacob's next camp was at a place called Sukkoth, S-U-C-C-O-T-H, and we see that in verse 16. Still in Genesis 33, verse 16. So Esau returned that day on his way unto Seir, and Jacob journeyed to Sukkoth and built him a house. That's interesting. And made booths. And the word for house is bayith, and the Hebrew word for booths is sukkah, for his cattle, made booths for his cattle. Therefore, the name of the place is called Sukkoth. And Sukkoth is a word that many of us will be familiar with. You know, we've been in the church for a long time, and the word, you can look it up, it's in Strong's 5523, and it means booth. But as we know, as the keepers of God's feast know, we have thought of it over the centuries as temporary dwelling. Again, the Hebrew word for house here in verse 17 was not Sukkoth, but Bayit at Strong's 1004. But still, we can be sure that it certainly was not meant to be a permanent dwelling, because although the time frame is not mentioned here, in the very next verse we read of Jacob and his group moving on to yet another place. So they didn't stay in this house that they built on that property there. Verse 18, and Jacob came to Shalem. So they moved away from Sukkoth, came to this place called Shalem, a city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram and pitched his tent before the city. Excuse me. Well, Shalem comes from the same Hebrew word as Salem or Salem, which means peace. Okay, Strong's 8004. Now, some Bible commentators maintain that this Shalem mentioned here was the same place as Salem, which later became Jerusalem or Jerusalem. But the mention of it in verse 18 as being a city of Shechem would indicate the possibility that it was not the same place, because the city of Shechem was 54 kilometers or about 34 miles north of what we now know as Jerusalem. If Shalem and Salem were, for some possibility, the same place, perhaps the mention of it being a city of Shechem would mean that the Shechem that is referred to here was not referred to as a city, but as a man. Perhaps a major landowner who owned cities in that area. And we see this possibility come up, and it's supported by subsequent verses which clearly and repeatedly mention Shechem the man. And Shechem the man was a prince. He was the son of a king whose name was Hamor. Now, it's not unusual back in those early years that these city-states had their own individual monarchies. They were as common back then as the larger countries, and perhaps even more so in those early years. And a few examples of city-states still exist in Europe today. I think there's one in Asia. I think Singapore is looked upon as a city-state, but in Europe you've got Gibraltar, you've got San Marino, you've got Monaco, you've got the Vatican City, and there are others as well. But it's interesting what it says here in verse 18, that Jacob pitched his tent, and it's more probably tents. I'm sure they all weren't staying in one tent, all of his sons and their families. But he pitched his tent, it says, before the city, not in the city. Maybe in this case, I'm sure he knew what his forefather Lot had done, and perhaps he learned the bad examples of his forefather Lot. You don't have to turn there now, we've been through that in Genesis chapters 13, 14 and 19. We see that Lot and his group initially pitched their tents before the city of Sodom, but later, for one reason that we don't know, they moved into a permanent house in the city of Sodom, and we know that things went bad from there. But Jacob and his group did not go into the city of Shechem, nor did they dwell in houses there, but they stayed in their tents. But Jacob did buy some land there. Look at verse 19. And he bought a parcel of a field where he had spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And he erected there an altar and called it El Elohi Israel. I'm not sure whether his purchase of this field was approved by God. I'm not sure whether it is or not, but we'll see what happened after that. Let's look at this altar that he built, El Elohi Israel. I look in my lexicon and it tells me that the altar's name means the mighty God of Israel. That's a reasonable translation, I suppose. But if we break it down into its component Hebrew words, we come with El Elohi Israel. Four words. And in modern English, it means God, God, power, God. And it's like a treble acknowledgement of God as the all-powerful one. The all-powerful one. But, again, there's a maybe here, another maybe, and that's maybe Jacob's purchase of this property in the land of Canaan might perhaps have been another no-no, another premature no-no. Because as we read in chapter 34, we're going to go into chapter 34 now, this immediately led to a major skirmish, a major scrap between Jacob's group and the Canaanite residents of the land. And this was a skirmish in which the character of Jacob and his family did not come out in a very positive light because of the things that they did. And just as with Jacob's father's scraps, just as with Jacob's grandfather's scraps and tiffs and skirmishes with the rulers of some of the countries in which they stayed too long, this fight also blew up over, the same as happened in their cases, and it was a woman, and it was the beauty of a woman. And in this case, it was over Jacob's daughter, Dinah. Now, this is a pretty well-known account, and I don't want to go through it now. We have some young ears present, but it also tells us of the Shalemites, their wish to intermarry with Jacob's family and to have them settle there. Wanted Jacob's family to settle down and intermarry with their people in that land. So Genesis chapter 34 and verse 8, and Hamor, king of Shalem, communed with them, with Jacob and his son, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. I pray you give her him to wife, and make you marriages with us, and give your daughters unto us, and take our daughters unto you, and you shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade you therein, and get you possessions therein." At this point in time, the Lord certainly was having none of that. When these things did begin to happen, in other words, when the Lord did allow the Israelites to settle in the land of Canaan, and when he did eventually begin allowing intermarriage, he did so according to his will and his timing. Anyway, after more trickery from Simeon and Levi, evidently, in this respect, they were tricksters, and perhaps they were chips off the old block, maybe off the old blocks of their father Jacob and their maternal grandfather Laban. But after much bloodshed, and with a surprising lack of faith as we read through this, Jacob started to fear the Shalemites. He became unhappy about his group losing popularity and respect from these people. He became unhappy that his group were no longer welcome to stay in that area, in the Shalemite area. And he was unhappy about the necessity for them to move out of it. So you see, there's this resistance for change. There was the God wanted them to keep on moving, and over again they resisted it, and I believe that they were punished for doing so. Verse 30, "And Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have troubled me to make me stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And I, being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house." But as we move now into chapter 35, we see that the Lord quickly moved them on southward, got them out of there, and moved them on southward again. Genesis chapter 35 now and verse 1. "And God," that's Elohim, "said unto Jacob, arise, go up unto Bethel, and dwell there, and make there an altar unto God," unto El, "that appeared unto you when you fled from the face of Esau your brother." So this was the same Bethel where Jacob, on his outbound journey northwards toward Paddan Aram originally, years and years before, had his vision of this amazing ladder, or this amazing stairway, this amazing gateway to the heavenly house of God. And the Hebrew for the house of God is Beit El, or Bethel. So Jacob's first experience at Bethel on his way north had quite naturally, quite obviously made such a great impression on him. So because of that, he had his people, his sons, his daughter-in-laws, he had them make strict preparations for his second visit. Well, maybe God initiated these instructions, or maybe he didn't. The scriptures don't say. But he is just part of the instructions that Jacob gave. Verse 2. Then Jacob said unto his household and to all that were with him, put away the strange gods that are among you, and be clean, and change your garments. Verse 4. And they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods which were in their hand, and all their earrings which were in their ears. And Jacob hid them under the oak which was by Shechem. Now, I'm not sure what the problem was with the earrings, or why the earrings were associated with the strange gods. The Lord, in at least one of the scripture later on, certainly seems to approve the use of earrings, but perhaps these ones may have had some idolatrous heathen markings on them. We don't know, it doesn't say why. But the mentions here in verses 2 and 4 about the strange gods, this is pretty bizarre in some respects. If you think about it, it's curious that Jacob, if he had in fact known about them, if he had known that members of his family had these, you know, possessed these strange heathen gods, that if they had them for any length of time, it would be strange that he would have allowed them to be kept. And it's also strange that the Lord had not done something about them before then as well. Again, there's some possibility, though, that Jacob had not known about them until this point, and perhaps the Lord revealed it to him in advance of the group's arrival at this place, this Bethel, this very holy place. The idolatry in the family may have come down from Abraham's predecessors. As I mentioned, you don't have to turn there, you can just jot it down if you want to. Joshua chapter 24 and verse 2, where it mentions that some of them worshipped idols, heathen idols. It certainly, we know that Laban had idols, possessed idols, and that's probably not really surprising when we think about his personality and his character. We think it might be more surprising to some extent that it was adopted, that heathen idols were adopted by Jacob's favorite wife, Rachel. And we read about that in chapter 31. We'll touch on it again later, but we won't let it hold us up now. Let's continue with the family's troubles. Still in Genesis 35, let's back up. We skipped over verse 3. So Jacob's still speaking here, verse 3. And let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make there an altar unto God, who answered me in the day of my distress, and was with me in the way which I went, in other words, on his outbound northward journey toward Paddan Aram, looking for a wife. And he got two. Verse 5. And they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were round about them, and they did not pursue after the people of the cities round about them did not pursue after the sons of Jacob. And remember what we read a couple of minutes ago, that Jacob expressed fear that might happen, that they might be defeated and wiped out by the people of the land. God made sure that that would not happen. Verse 6. So Jacob came to Luz, which is in the land of Canaan, that is Bethel, he and all the people that were with him. And he built there an altar and called the place El Bethel, which means the God of the house of God, because there God, Elohim, had appeared unto him when he fled from the face of his brother. It's interesting when you see when Jacob names places, for some reason he likes to include multiples in those place names. I don't know why, in the place names that he initiated, the God of the house of God. But anyway, it was then and there that God repeated the Abrahamic covenant promises to Jacob, and as well as repeating the name change that he gave him after the wrestling match back at Peniel. Verse 9, and God, Elohim, appeared unto Jacob again when he came out of Paddan Aram and blessed him. And God, Elohim again, said unto him, your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called any more Jacob, but Israel shall be your name. And he called his name Israel. God then told Jacob who he was, who he is, and what his name was and is, or at least one of his names anyway. Verse 11, and God, Elohim, said unto him, unto Jacob, I am God Almighty. Hebrew name there is El Shaddai, which means the supremely powerful one, the supremely powerful God. He then repeated to Jacob the brief overview, a brief overview of his promised Abrahamic covenant blessings, and also one of his earlier stated priorities for his early peoples. Be fruitful and multiply, he says, continuing in verse 11. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall be of you, and kings shall come out of your loins. Verse 12, and the land which I gave to Abraham, that's interesting, which I gave Abraham and Isaac, to you I will give it, and to your seed after you will I give the land. The tenses are interesting in verse 12. The mainly future tense, referring to Jacob, I will give it to you, and to your seed after you will I give the land. But also, please note that the Lord says here that he gave the land to Jacob's father and grandfather. The word gave here is in the Hebrew perfect tense, which indicates that the action, and in this case the Lord's giving of the land to Abraham and Isaac, had been completed. And we know that it was, the land of Canaan was as good as theirs, but the Lord had not allowed them to fully settle in the land permanently during their lifetimes. He had given it to them. He said, this is yours, but I'm going to allow you to die, to go to the grave, and you'll get it later on. Okay, and your people are going to get it, but I have given it to you, so good night. Likewise for Jacob and his family, they would not actually take possession of it right away. So off they went. He sent them out again on the road again, and also once again more troubles arose. Verse 16, and they journeyed from Bethel, and there was but a little way to come to Ephrath, and Rachel travailed, and she had hard labor. Now, a couple of months ago, in one of our New Moon Bible studies, we examined the town of Ephrath, Strong's 672. We examined it in quite a bit of detail. And if you remember, you may not remember the term Ephrath, you might remember that it can mean ash heap, and also it can mean a place of fruitfulness. They don't even seem together, but the name Ephrath is derived from the verb para, which is Strong's 6509, and it means fruitful, increased. It means to grow, to bear fruit, and to branch off. Now, some of these terms, certainly because young Benjamin was born there, they are significant to Jacob's family, significant to the increase in Jacob's family as it was increased by the birth of Benjamin. And most of these terms, you know, fruitful, increased, bear fruit, and all of those are very significant in regards to Jesus' commands to us, to his new covenant peoples, to increase and to grow. To increase and to grow in grace and in knowledge, and to bear spiritual fruit, to be fruitful branches of him who is the vine. So, verse 17, and it came to pass, when she was in hard labour, Rachel was in hard labour, that the midwife said unto her, Fear not, you shall have this son also. And it came to pass, as her soul was in departing, and a soul, it's not like your liver or your heart or something like, talking about the Hebrew is nephesh or nephesh, which it refers to a person's physical life and human spirit. Her soul was in departing, for she died, that she called his name Benoni. But his father called him Benjamin. She wanted to call him Benoni. His father called him Benjamin. Did you ever wonder why Jacob overruled Rachel's name for her son? Benoni, the Hebrew rendition of it is Ben-Oni, Ben-O-W-N-I-Y, Strong's 1126, is generally and say compassionately understood as meaning son of my sorrow or son of my trouble. Probably from the idea of Rachel's hard labor and the fact that she died before being able to enjoy any time with her second child. The name Ben-Oni stems from the words Ben, meaning son, it's okay, and Oni, which is a derivation of the noun Aven, A-V-E-N. And Aven is a very common noun throughout the scriptures. In the Old Testament, you'll find it 78 times, 78 appearances of it. And Aven can mean sorrow and mourning and trouble and affliction. But if we look at all of the 78 renditions of it in the Old Testament, it is more commonly rendered as, listen to these words, vanity, false, mischief, unjust, unrighteous, iniquity, wickedness, evil, idol, and idolatry. So some of these words, I'd say a lot of those words might be very relevant to Rachel's stealing of her father Laban's heathen gods. And not just stealing them, but possessing them, owning them, and keeping them. We always think of Rachel as Jacob's first, actually second, but his first choice as a wife, and his favorite wife. We always think of Rachel as the cute one, right, of the two, of Laban's two daughters. And because she was cute, or we think she was cute, we might have the idea that butter would not have melted in their mouth. I don't know about you, I've known beautiful women in the past who have not been, you know, so very nice. Yeah, present company except, of course. But we might, because of their beauty, we might tend to make the mistake of sweeping Rachel's idol incident under the rug. God doesn't do that. He's not a respecter of persons. But all I'm asking here is, could Rachel's name for a second son possibly have been a kind of deathbed repentance, perhaps implying my childbearing agony and untimely death through the birth of this son, Ben, is just punishment from God for my wicked sin of idolatry? Possibility, I don't know. But if so, if that's true, then we can easily understand why Jacob would not have wanted his youngest son growing up with a name like that. This name, Benoni, would have virtually, because of its common use of that word, would have said to anybody who was ever introduced to him, "Hi, my name's Benoni," it is basically saying, "My mother was a wicked idolater." So you can see why Jacob would not want that for his youngest son. So Jacob overruled Rachel's choice of names and called the child Benjamin. More accurately, Ben-Yamin. Ben-Yamin means son of my right hand or son of the south. And if you face an east, then the south is on your right hand. Little Benjamin was born near Ephrath. Ephrath is near Bethlehem. It's not in the southernmost part of Canaan where they were going, that's true, but it certainly was very far south in comparison to where all of Jacob's other children had been born, and, you know, where Jacob and his family had been for the previous umpteen years. Verse 19. And Rachel died and was buried in the way to Ephrath, which is in Bethlehem. Again, not actually at Ephrath, but in the way to it, and as it says in verse 16, a little way from it. Modern Bethlehem is only about 8 kilometers south of Jerusalem, or 5 miles south of Jerusalem. And that might give, or this might give, another indication that the original Bethel, which they just left, they went Bethel to Ephrath on their way south, that the original Bethel was actually at Jerusalem. Possibility? Something to think about. Did Jacob stay there at Ephrath? No, he didn't. Verse 21. And Israel journeyed and spread his tent beyond the Tower of Edar. The Tower of Edar, it was a place name, and the place name was Migdal Eder. Migdal Eder. And that was evidently somewhere, I looked it up, I couldn't find out exactly where it was, but it was evidently somewhere not too far south of Ephrath and Bethlehem, but still again southbound en route towards Isaac's camp. So now they were in the home stretch, they were getting pretty close to home, but as it says here in verse 21, they were still living in tents. So they were still nomadic at that time. Verse 22, and it came to pass when Israel dwelt, when Israel dwelt in that land, the word is Shakan, not Yashab. Okay, not Yashab. Once again, I there's a lot of nasty stuff that happened here at Migdal Eder, and I don't want to go into that pretty bloodthirsty stuff. So we'll move right along from there. You can read that whenever you want. Finally, after all this time now, after all that yashabing, after all of that sojourning, after all of that travelling, Jacob was at long last reunited with his father, Isaac, and his group. Rebecca was evidently dead by this time. But where did the reunification take place? It was not at Beer Laharoi, where they'd been when Jacob left so many years before. Verse 27, and Jacob came unto Isaac and his father, unto Mamre, unto the city of Arba, which is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac sojourned, had previously sojourned, or Gur is the word for sojourn. So since Jacob had left and gone north all of those years before, old Isaac, his father, and the family group had evidently done some more travelling of their own and had relocated yet again, and they were back in the Mamre Hebron area. We're not given, we can imagine that the reunification was so very happy and joyful between Isaac and Jacob. We're not given an account of it, but, and we're not absolutely sure of the timing here, but from the way that it's written, immediately after his return, in verse 28 is what we read, and the days of Isaac were 180 years, and Isaac gave up the ghost, gave up the human spirit, and died, and was gathered unto his people. Okay? Did he go to heaven? No. Did he go down there? No. It just merely means he went to the grave where all of his people were. He hit the dirt. Second half of verse 29, being old and full of days, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. This is interesting. Ishmael had returned to the family camp for Abraham's funeral. And just in the same way, Esau returned to the family camp for Isaac's funeral. And again, we're not sure when Rebekah died. Rebekah was Isaac's wife and Jacob's mother when she died. And the scriptures don't tell us, but it was likely during the time when Jacob was away. Rebekah's death is only mentioned, and it was mentioned by Jacob much later in chapter 49. Can you just bookmark where we are there in chapter 35, and let's go over to Genesis 49 just for one verse. Genesis 49 and verse 30. Genesis 49 and verse 30. In the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite for a possession of a burying place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife. And there I buried Leah. So that's from Jacob. Now Rebekah's death, and the fact that they wanted to bury Rebekah back in Machpelah by Hebron there, that might give the indication of why Isaac moved from Beer Lahairoi back up to Machpelah, back up to the Hebron area again while Jacob was away. Okay, let's go back to chapter 36, as we're just going to skip into and out of chapter 36. We see that just as in the case of Ishmael, Esau didn't stick around after Isaac's funeral either. He made himself scarce and he returned home to his home area of Seir. Genesis chapter 36 and verse 6. And Esau took his wives and his sons and his daughters and all the persons of his house and his cattle and all his beasts and all his substance which he had got in the land of Canaan, and went into the country from the face of his brother Jacob, for their riches were more than that they might dwell together, and the land wherein they were strangers could not bear them because of their cattle. Thus dwelt Esau in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. So more trouble, more separation, and more scattering. And seemingly for similar reasons as Abraham had separated from Lot. Remember when Abraham and Lot split up because they couldn't get it together. There seems to be some implication here that after Isaac's funeral, perhaps Esau and Jacob did give reunification another try, but it wasn't to be. And maybe, even probably, for the good, because their personalities were like oil and water, as we know. But obviously, we know where the line was, that God said he was going to bless Jacob, he was going to bless Israel, and that the Abrahamic covenant was going to go down that line, not Esau's line, not Ishmael's line. And so what happens then is the narrative leaves Esau now, but before it leaves Esau, in order to, again, to follow the family line of Jacob, Israel, the author of this part of Genesis seems to honor Esau by listing his descendants. So he's going to leave him on a positive note. Many of his descendants, it says, and we won't read it all now, but many of them became what the Bible called dukes. High-ranking people and even kings. And so Esau's line had kings long before Israel had kings. So that's kind of interesting. Okay, let's go into chapter 37, verse 1. Genesis chapter 37 and verse 1. And Jacob dwelt, Yashabd, in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. Now we're not told here exactly, in this particular verse, we're not told exactly where in Canaan Jacob and his family were Yashabing, where they were dwelling. But we soon find out that they were still in the Vale of Hebron at this time, and quite close to the area of Shechem. For want of any further detail, we don't get any more detail, let's assume that they were still in the Mamre area. If you wanted to trace it on maps or something like that, as I did, they were still in the Mamre area. Don't know how long, how many months or years or weeks or whatever had gone past, but was it a problem that they were Yashabing here? You know, we have God seems to have had a problem when they Yashabed, when they dwelt too long in a given area. He wanted them to keep on moving for his own good reasons. Was it a problem? And if it was a problem, did the usual trouble ensue from this instance of Yashabing? Well, yes, it did. Major, major trouble. History-changing trouble. And we won't go into all the trouble. We'll go into all of the detail today. And I'm sure everybody knows the accounts of what happened to young Joseph. I'm not going to go into all of that detail. But Joseph was a victim, if you will, of respective persons. Many scriptures tell us that in God's eyes, that respect of persons is a sin. And I'm sure that this would include respect of persons within a family. When we were away, I think we were in Ireland somewhere, and I saw in one of those t-shirt shops, it said, I am the favorite son, or something like that, you know. I am the favorite child, or something like that, it said. Anyway, that respect of persons within a family could be a sin as well, to the point of, you know, favoritism of certain of a parent's children obviously is going to cause trouble. And Jacob's love for Joseph resulted in Joseph's brother's hatred for him. So excessive love led to excessive hatred in that family. Did it result in more traveling? Did this situation result in more separation and scattering? Well, yes, it did. And again, you know the story. Did young Joseph do some of this traveling too? Yes, he did. As his father, as his grandfather, as his great-grandfather had done, he did some traveling, and much of it was not voluntary. Well, first, just to please his father, by obtaining news of his brother's welfare, Joseph did take a voluntary trip, a very fateful trip, as it happened. Verse 12, and his brethren went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said unto Joseph, do not your brethren feed the flocks in Shechem? Come, and I will send you unto them. And he said to him, here am I, send me. And he said to him, go, I pray you, see whether it be well with your brethren and well with the flocks, and bring me word again. So he sent him out of the vale of Hebron. So we know that they were still in the vale of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. One of the things I want you to notice here and drill it into your mind is that there's a requirement for sheep owners and shepherds to continually move around in order to find good nutritious pasture for their sheep. Again, I ask you to lock that fact in your memory, because we're going to come back to it in a few weeks' time. It's a very important point. As I mentioned earlier there, I don't believe that the Shechem mentioned here and in the earlier verses there is the city which is of modern day Nablus, okay? The city of Nablus, which was previously called Shechem, was about 50 miles north of Hebron as the crow flies. Very unlikely distance for shepherds to travel with their flocks, you know, on foot with all of those sheep. Rather, I believe that the area being referred to was likely a large, broad area of land which had been ruled by Prince Shechem, who we read about earlier, and his father, King Hamor, and that, you know, and that it was a large stretch of land that came right down into that area, reasonably close to Hebron. Verse 15, and a certain man found him, and behold, he, Joseph, was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, what seek you? And he said, I seek my brethren. Tell me, I pray you, where they feed their flocks. And the man said, they are departed hence, for I heard them say, let's go to Dothan. And Joseph went after his brethren and found them in Dothan. I looked up Dothan to see where ancient Dothan might have been, and I couldn't find where it is today. One source says that it was at the south end of the Jezreel Valley, but that's very unlikely because the Jezreel Valley is about 75 miles north of Hebron as the crow flies. So I doubt if even the very keenest shepherds would have traveled that far to feed their flocks. Verse 18, and when they saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. Now we know how the story goes. Reuben convinced his brothers not to kill Joseph, and Judah, and I kind of smile at this because Judah must have inherited some of his uncle Laban's genes, came up with an idea to sell Joseph as a slave to some Midianite Ishmaelites. Let's make some money here. Verse 25, and they sat down to eat bread, and they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead, which is up in the northeast, with their camels bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt, in other words, southbound to Egypt. And Judah said unto his brethren, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him. So he's saying, what profit is it? He wanted profit. Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let our hand be, let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh, and his brethren were content. Then there passed by Midianites, merchantmen, and they, Joseph's brothers, drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they brought Joseph, the Ishmaelites brought Joseph into Egypt. Verse 36, and the Midianites sold him into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and captain of the guard. So came Joseph's momentous and history-changing journey, but involuntary journey, obviously, into Egypt. And so we'll leave the family's travels there for today, and we'll pick up the account in a few weeks' time. We'll come back to it and we'll move on.